Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Phil Rowley is a stillwater icon. Author, presenter, fly tyer, and instructor, Phil has shared his knowledge and paved the road for countless anglers. I was excited to finally have him on the show to learn more about his entrance into the fly fishing industry. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss chronomids, triploids, feeling boxed in, and how he went from working in an insurance office to working full-time in the fishing industry. I'm also delighted to let you know that we finally opened the doors yesterday to our highly anticipated chronomid fishing class with Brian Chan. Early bird pricing and perks are in effect until this Friday at midnight, so you've got 2 days to go over to anchoredoutdoors.com to grab Brian's class while prices are this low. The class will teach you everything you need to know about chronomids and how to fish them. Brian does not hold back while he shares over 40 years worth of knowledge, including entomology in the chronomid life cycle, tackle requirements, floating techniques, sinking techniques, fishing multiple flies, boat setup, matching the hatch, throat pumping, fly tying, and so much more. So head on over to anchoredoutdoors.com, look for the masterclass tab, and you will find it right at the very top. Enjoy.
I was born in Liverpool, England, and lived there for 7 years, emigrated to Canada in October of 1969, landed in Vancouver, and spent our first year living in Chilliwack, which you know rather well.
Yeah.
And then my dad got a job over on Vancouver Island, so I moved over there, I would say 1970, early 71, and then lived on Vancouver Island till just after high school. And then moved over to the greater Vancouver area, bright lights, big city, lots for young people to do there. And then too poor to move home, and then just lived in the greater Vancouver area, slowly moving east. As you know, when you live there, as the way house prices are, you can't afford to slide west. You can only move east out into the suburbs, and lived there for 35 years in BC, and then moved to Alberta 16 years ago. Total change of career. I had when I got out of school, I wanted to be a pilot. That was what I had hoped to be, but fell victim of the first recession in the 80s when airlines were laying off. And I was sort of just got my commercial pilot's license, which, you know, basically I knew enough to be dangerous and trying to build hours. And I was trying to get, you know, a job up in northern BC, flying a float plane or a bush, you know, and just building up hours. And airlines were laying people off left, right and center at that time. So you were competing with laid off airline captains, which I didn't have the skill or the experience to match up with that. So ended up working, got a job ground floor level with big insurance company in BC. And then, the one. And then.
Are there any others? I thought there was just one.
There is. It was a good experience as far as learning management skills and training and all that stuff. Worked there for 16 years as a manager. Kind of got asked to swap careers and went over, well, not swap careers, swapped, went over the other side of the fence, you could say, and worked for a collision repair company for 7 years. I was the head of human resources there when I left and training. And then, as you know, with my relationship with Brian, we worked with a Canadian company called Superfly and worked together and developed a Stillwater Solutions product line. And that relationship led to a job offer that moved me to Alberta, where I became the operations manager for them for about 4.5 years.
Whoa. Okay.
Sorry. You get me rolling.
Now I get to bring you back all those years.
Sure.
Were your parents English?
Yep. Yep. I'm my sister's English by birth. My parents were. My father had spent right after World War II. He was too. My mom and dad were too young to participate, you know, in the military sense. But they vividly remember it, you know, being bombed and the rations and those kind of things. And right after World War II, England had mandatory service. So my dad, I think, wanted to go in the RAF, but I think they only offered him like a 25-year hitch. And he was like, no, I don't think I want to commit 25 years just out of, you know, just early adulthood. So he joined the Merchant Navy. So he basically sailed the world, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, over to New York, all those kind of places, down into the Caribbean. And I think he came to the realization at that time, the way he saw England going at that time, he felt there was more opportunity outside of England. So he looked to emigrate and in his research, he'd done Canada and New Zealand. So he applied to go to both and Canada accepted his immigration application first and over we came. So he came over about a year before we did.
Right. Was he a fisherman?
Nope.
All of those places are so amazing with, you know, they all have great fishing.
Nope. He said he tried it a couple of times and just didn't work for him. Didn't flip any switch in his head, but he liked, he was really into woodworking and cabinetry. That was sort of his hobby was making furniture and stuff, which for my wife and I, when we were just married and couldn't afford much, getting furniture, homemade furniture out of oak and teak was kind of nice.
Right. No kidding. Yeah. So then how did you get started?
It was. It actually traces back to England. I had a neighbor across the street by the name of Peter Hopley, and he coarse fishing was big there. I didn't really get into fly fishing, but every Sefton Park in Liverpool had a pond, and you know, carp were the sort of the signature fish, the premier fish you were trying to get. But you would chase roach, perch, rudd, bream. Pile of others. I probably missed a whole pile. But anyway, you would go down. I remember, you know, I must have been 5 or 6, but it's just little fragments of your memory at that time. Going into some tackle shop and buying maggots with Peter. And then we would go down and you'd set up a, you know, basically float fishing with baits and you had a keep net. You kept everything. And then at the end of the day, you release them all. There was no, you know, game fishing over there. As I later became, you know, you kill trout and salmon. Whereas coarse fish, you release them and you, yeah. So,
that's strange because to me, it's always like kill the coarse fish, but wait, why not just release them at the time of, why would you collect them all?
I'm not sure. I was 5 or 6, so I didn't know. You just caught one, threw it in the keep, and this keep nets were, you stake them to the bank and then they, you know, they were kind of tubular and went out 6 or 7 feet and you would just throw everything in there. I think it comes. There's a lot of competition fishing over in Europe and in England, both fly fishing and coarse fishing. And I think that's where you would keep your fish, you know, and when the judges came around and you had to weigh your, you know, the different weigh-in points. You had to, you know, show your fish and weigh them. And then maybe you got to let them go after that. But at five or six, I was just, that's what we did. So that's what I did. Yeah.
Okay. So then you come to Canada. And then do you remember the first time you went fishing here?
Yes. My dad bought me a little spin casting rod with a, I remember used to get a little rubber practice casting weight on it, like a little rubber teardrop dumbbell thing. And I remember being in the backyard trying to cast this thing. It was white. It was a white blank, you know, push button. So you fire it and usually it lands right at your feet, right? Because you got to figure the whole timing of it all. And then we were on the Chilliwack or the Vedder River. And I remember because my dad's good friend at the time, Jerry, was a fly fisherman. Now that I look back, it's all these little things that flash back. At the time, I didn't think much of it, but he had the wicker creel and the bamboo fly rod, and he took a couple of fish, and I just remember how smelly they were in that creel at the end of the day. But I was using my little spin caster, giving my dad a heart attack because I must have been maybe seven. And I was running all over log jams like a mouse. And of course, as a parent, you'd be like, oh my God, he's going to fall through. Right. But I didn't know, but I didn't fall through. So yeah, that was my first time was fishing on the bed. I don't think I caught a thing.
Was it for salmon, steelhead or trout?
Oh, I think we were just fishing for resident trout at the time. Right. I remember it wasn't the Vedder you and I remember from winter steelheading or the coho returns. That was typically the two times I used to hit that river, but it was warmer. I remember, you know, maybe it was late fall or something like that, but there was no salmon because it wasn't crowded. That's for sure. I think we were in the upper Chilliwack as I look at it. Cause we weren't down on the lower section. We were above Vedder Crossing.
Right. Oh, it's so beautiful up there. Well, no wonder why it's stuck. So then at that point, where does that put us with your age? Are you around 10?
No, still living in Chilliwack. So that would have put me, I would say, six or seven.
Okay. So really quite young. And then as you started to move over, walk me through your fly fishing career or your fishing career in general. Was it something that, because I'll be honest, I didn't realize you had all those, you know, quote unquote, real jobs. I've just always assumed that you were solely in the fly fishing industry because that's when I mean, you're just such a big name in fly fishing. So when did your entrance into the industry happen?
That would have started, you know, I picked up fly fishing early 20s, really got seriously into it. I had a friend who I played hockey with at the time, was trying to get me out to fly fish and you know. And then my wife and I, early in our marriage, we were over on Cameron Lake on Vancouver Island, known for brown trout. We had been there a week and I think I had, you know, I was just trolling around and trolling Doc Spratleys and flatfish. And I think we had one poor little 11-inch rainbow on that. The only reason I knew he was on there is I decided it was time to change whatever we were using. And as I reeled in, the poor thing was hanging on there because he weighed less than the weight that was used to drag everything down. So we got nothing. And I remember sitting around one evening where the campground was. There was the outflow, I think, into the Little Qualicum. And this, my wife and I looked back. It was almost like Roderick Haig Brown walked by. It was this traditional wicker creel, fly rod, hip boots, walks into the lake up to about his thighs or his knees, fishes for an hour, catches a number of trout, keeps a couple and leaves. And it was kind of this surreal fog, you know, and little flips, switch flips in my head. Maybe I should, you know, follow up with Richard, my friend, and go fishing. So we went out. He gave me some rudimentary casting lessons, you know, spent more time hitting myself and breaking it, just typical with an old fiberglass rod. And we went up to the Skagit the following weekend and I caught a fish on a dry fly. I still remember it. His father had caught a fish and let me play for a little bit with it because I was just beating the water to a froth as most of us were when we were first learning. And, but then, so that was pretty neat. But then there was fish rising. I remember it was downstream of 26 Mile Bridge, I think, as I look back. And it was a log jam. And I was, you know, basically perpendicular. It was fish sliding out from underneath the log and taking, I think, ants. And so I put a fly on. Fish came up and ate it. I didn't miss the take. Probably a good thing, because most of us, you know, as we get more experienced, we get a little more anticipation and pull the fly out of the fish's mouth. I didn't know enough, right? I probably had so much slack. I probably did try to set early, but by the time I got all the slack out of the system, you know, the hook, the fish had a chance to take the fly. And I remember I had never fought a fish like I'd caught, you know, growing up, we caught bullheads off the dock on Vancouver Island, pile perch and, you know, big cabazon. The odd time we get a ling cod. I remember going out in an inflatable raft when I was in my teens in school. We would go out to these markers wrapped around in kelp, and we'd spent our allowance on about 3 buzz bombs, a tray of anchovies, and we'd eventually lose that. And then I remember wrapping tinfoil around a hook, right? And we'd catch rock cod, rock bass.
Oh, it worked. Well, yeah, I guess why not?
Yeah, yeah. And then we'd take them home because, of course, you had to, that was just what you did, right? And so, yeah, that's the kind of fishing I'd done, but I had never caught a fish on a fly rod and had that total connection between you and the fish, no weight, no gear in between. And just, I knew that from that moment forward, that's what I want. And I just became a sponge. I remember going to the library, taking out books. You learn, and then I always liked biology in school and those kind of things. So the whole entomology and bug thing, that really appealed to me, right? Because it was, you know, for the first time, I felt connected with nature. I understood, I could see things. Whereas before that, I would just put the green thing on, the red thing on, the silver one, because so-and-so said so. There was no rhyme or reason. So that's sort of where fly, and then I haven't done anything. You know, I still play around a little bit with conventional gear now and then, but I much prefer, you know, where I am in Alberta now, I chase walleye on the fly. Not because they're particularly great game fish on the fly. No, nothing against walleye, I'm not here. But you're not supposed to catch them, right? That's not a fly rod fish in most people's eyes, but they are. If it swims and eats, I'm interested in chasing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Well, I've got a few questions for you here. So while you've got your, you know, real job, I hate saying that. While you've got your 9-to-5.
Traditional. So
let's your traditional job. Were you, obviously you were still fishing, but at any point were you thinking, I might like to venture into the fly fishing industry?
Yeah, that started to, you know, I joined the Osprey Fly Fishers. You know, I wanted to learn more. And a club was a way, you know, to do it. I remember taking a night school fly fishing course, and you know, the instructor recommended, you know, was a member of the club, and said you can come out. So, you know, that was pretty nervous, because you just walk into this, you're an individual in strangers, right? It's just very intimidating. But they welcomed the president at the time, Don McDermott, was very welcoming, you know, which was nice. And you just started participating like anything. You get involved and you tried to do as much as you could and learn. And then they had a newsletter, and I started writing columns. You know, I just dabbled in writing. And I actually did a fly column in there called Phil's Fly Box, where I would do flies in every issue. And this was back when things were printed on, was it a Gestetner? Was that the machine they used to call those things? You know, the hand crank things. And I'm really dating myself. So started writing there, and then thought, somebody said, you're not half bad at this. I went, okay. I've always been conscious with my writing. I still don't think I get very, because to me, it's a total exposure of yourself, right? Like there's, you can get torn to pieces, or, you know, or just find out that you use the wrong words, the wrong tone, the wrong canto.
You stop trusting yourself because you read your words every year and you're like, oh, how did that get published? So lose all faith in yourself because you're so critical of your own writing. Yes. I understand.
Yeah. So,
anyway, you stuck with it. And why did you get that job? Was there something, or that role with them? Was there something special about your flies or your writing? Were you the only one who volunteered? I mean, why do you think?
Pretty well it. Like most of those volunteer, you know, most clubs, when I speak to clubs, and I'm sure you've seen it with your own speaking, if you close your eyes, you're at your own club meeting. You know, it's a large group of people that not everybody shows up, and a small percentage of that group actually is the driving force that goes with it. There's always financial challenges and what should we do challenges, and we need volunteers and we need help. And, you know, it's funny because I some of the clubs, they kind of say, I'm sorry you had to hear that. I says, oh, I have to tell you, you are not alone. This is every club meeting is exactly the same issues with getting people out, generating funds, what to do with those funds when you have them. That can, you know, anytime you get a large sum of money involved, it can get kind of interesting, you know, some pretty healthy discussions. So that gave me the confidence to know, well, I'm going to try and see if I can get a magazine article written, right?
Ah, okay. Yep.
So that led to that interest. And that was back when there was no email. You would type out a letter and send it off and wait. And then you'd get, you know, typical, the polite rejection letter. You know, your article does not meet our editorial needs. I remember that because it was common to a lot of them. And so eventually I got the guts to pick up the phone. And I phoned the editors and had some conversations. And I remember I spoke to Art Scheck at American Angler Magazine. And Art was great because what he told me, my subject matter, I was like, you know, how to tie, you know, how to fly fish lakes. He said, way too broad, right? I want you to go home or go sit down and write down everything that goes into fly fishing lakes. All, you know, basically a bullet. You know, I was on page 7, I think, just write, well, there's rods, there's lines, there's flies, there's reading the water, blah, 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 and on and on and on and on and on. And then I sent a submission back on how to fish chironomid larva, bloodworm, and he bit, right? And that was this first one. And then he took two others after there, an article on scuds. And that sort of started. And then I just started chasing around. And ironically, as a Canadian, I could not get a Canadian magazine interested in me. So I had articles already published in Fly Fisherman, American Angler, Fly Tire magazine, a little bit with the Amato publications. I remember talking to the editor of BC Magazine, we both know, asking, well, how come you don't write for us? Because you rejected me. And I think that's part of the at the time it's horrific, right? You just, oh man, I'm never going to do this and I'm never going to, and it's just taken off from there. And that led to deciding I thought about writing a book because there was no books on, you know, I got into stillwater fly fishing.
Well, that's my next question.
Sorry, I'm hopping ahead.
No, that's okay. Before you go into the book though, why? Because when I hear a little bit more about your history, I would have assumed that you would have become an avid salmon, steelhead, anything mm-hmm. sea-run angler.
Yep.
But you went to Stillwater.
Yeah, I guess. And I can't recall. You know, I went on fish outs, as we called them. Every month there was an outing. And I remember fishing the mouth of the Harrison River when you could go down there and catch pinks and chum. And that was a lot of fun on a 7-weight, you know, because that's all I had was a 7-weight. And but those were all seasonal. And then, of course, fishing systems like the Chilliwack Better, which get very populated at certain times of the year, that was challenging to get there. And you know, the lakes were just accessible. And I think we did, you know, I went up to Corbett Lake. BC Federation of Fly Fishers used to hold their AGM up there. So we did go up there every year. And I guess it was just stillwater fishing, you know, was more easy. It wasn't as seasonal as cutthroat fishing, even though they were around all year, but there were certain times it'd be better. And of course the anadromous stuff and steelheading, if you want a decent steelhead, you have to go up where you live part of the time up there now. And that was a haul.
Yeah,
I still had a muscle car back then. I had a Z28, the stupidest car for a fisherman to own, right? Like
especially somebody who works for ICBC.
Hey, cut that. Yeah. Yeah, I had that Z28. I remember stuffing a float tube in that. You know, if you went over a pebble, you hit the ground out. So I knew that car had to go. You needed a truck. Right. Or something you could carry stuff in. So, yeah, that's how the fly fishing started. And it just became apparent when you were trying to tie flies. And ironically, I didn't think I would enjoy tying flies. I took a fly fishing course first and kind of stayed away from fly tying. And then I guess I just decided, well, maybe I'll try this, and took another night school course in Coquitlam through continuing education. And I remember having the first session, and then the teacher couldn't make the next 2 weeks, so we were on hiatus for 2 weeks. So I had the ghillie. I had bought the ghillie at that time, and I was trying to learn how to tie flies by looking at pictures of flies in the ghillie, which
the
was
best book ever.
Ever, yes. Ever. You must
and
have
Brian
it.
Chan had written at that time, at you know, a
yes,
chapter, well, quite a bit of that book.
He did
so,
all the entomology. He did a few chapters, and he did the entomology sections in there. So that really appealed to me again, more the bugs. And and then the fly tying went, you know, initial frustrations at first, as I'm sure you can relate to, you know, especially when you've had one lesson. You know, I think the first fly we tied was called a Chernkov's bloodworm. It was basically wool, you know, a section of yarn, wool body, a rib, and a few strands of pheasant tail. So that was our first fly. And now I'm trying to try halfbacks and all these other things. I cannot figure it out. I'm frustrated. I'm angry. I'm venting at my wife. I'm never going to figure this out, kind of thing. And then thankfully he came back and the lessons, and then, you know, it just started. So I kept practicing and tying. And I guess some people thought I got not half bad at it. And that's what I would donate to auctions at the club. I would do a fly plaque, you know, learning how to do shadow boxes. When there was no internet, you just had to figure it out, trying to see what you could glue to a fly on a pinhead, you know, and then watch it all, you know, fall off, or, you know, come back in the next morning, they've all fallen off, the epoxy hasn't held, or it kind of half fell off, and then the epoxy sets, and now your fly's kind of sideways, and you have to, a lot of trial and error, you know, character building. So yeah, that's what started. It started to become apparent that there wasn't a lot of, I couldn't find any resource for stillwater flies. So I got the idea that I would write this book on, fly patterns for still waters. Was, you know, as you know, with fly tying titles, they're not always the most, they're not novel titles. You know, there's not some eye-catching title that makes you go, right? They're pretty describe what the book does. And I went to, at that time, my tying had started. I was starting to tie flies for local stores like Babcock Fly and Tackle, that's now Sea Run in Coquitlam, Ruddick's Fly Shop, Michael and Young. I would tie flies for gear, basically, right? I would give them my niche, when I got into commercial fly tying, I thought, I'm going to tie dry flies because nobody was doing that. And I knew why after, because they're very proportionally demanding and hackle is not cheap. I tried to do it with cheaper Indian necks and things like that, but you know, once you, at that time, Metz was, it was before Hoffman's and then Whiting is what it is now. And of course, Metz is still around and other manufacturers. But yeah, that was, I can remember dumping five dozen, I did Michelux edges, you know, that three-tiered, it's a elk hair tail and three tiers of elk hair, dubbed seal fur body, hackle in front. Not a smart fly to decide to do as a commercial tire. You know, that's a fly as a tire. Later in my commercial, if somebody asked you about it, it was either no or I've never heard of it.
Right.
Cut this off. So that's started doing that. So I, at that point, I was getting into the industry a little bit. I was starting to do a little bit of fly tying school courses at these fly shops. Getting involved, I actually thought of getting involved and buying a fly shop at one point. But I worked a few weekends at a fly shop and decided I didn't want to do that. That was a lot of, you know, packaging seals for getting into exhaustive discussions on loop-to-loop versus nail-knot connections, you know, all this stuff. So, so I got invited to go down to Denver at the time where the Fly Tackle retailer show is. Is it back there now? I can't remember. I think it is.
Yeah, I think it's Utah this year. Last year, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Two years ago, it was Denver. It went back. Yeah.
So I went there and had a little duotang. Remember what those were? Duotang? Yeah.
your duotang. Yeah. Oh,
yeah, because that's what you put the proposal in, right? Typed
that.
Out. And yeah. I went out and there was a couple of publishers there and I gave it to two or three of them. And I got home and Frank Amato called me, right? I never got an answer from the other ones, but he called me and the rest is history. I started work on my first book, right?
How cool is that?
at the time. Cool. And then the work kicks in, right? Because not only do you have to write when you do a fly tying book, you have to take pictures.
Pictures. Yep. Macro, I hear that's the hardest part.
Self-taught macro photography. Again, there's no internet. You had no digital imagery. It was all slides. So you would take a bunch of, you know, and you'd get them all back and throw them in the garbage. I would sit there with a loop and just in the garbage. I remember I took a photo photography class at the San Mateo Fly Fishing Show. It wasn't the Fly Fishing Show. San Mateo was a in the Ed Rice outdoor show. I can't remember exactly. But anyway, Sportsman Show. That's right. The San Mateo Sportsman Show. And Lefty Cray was doing a thing, a session on photography. And he said something that stuck in my mind to this day. Photographs are not like fine wine. They will not get better with a bad photograph is not like fine wine. It will not get better with age. So throw it out early, right? So I remember my wife would slide film was not cheap back then, and you would exhaust the whole roll. And I had a little, every time I took a shot, I had, written down shot one was at this aperture, this speed, this lighting. And when you got one back that you liked, what the hell was I doing? So I could duplicate that, right?
Good point.
And that's, yeah. I taught myself how to do macro photography, because you couldn't find out much in the way of answers from, local photography shops. If they weren't into it, they didn't know. And of course there was no internet, there's no email. You're just a lot of walking into concrete walls and frustration, but figured it out. And then everything went digital. So now you can crop and zoom in. You still have to have good basic photography skills and understand how it is. But we hear some people struggling today with something like, oh, you haven't gone through slide film where there was no adjustment. It was like raw. You couldn't do anything with it. Right. It's just frustrating. Yeah. So that was the first book and people seemed to like it.
So what happened then? How was the response in Canada? I've always been curious about that.
Good. For that one, because there was nothing. I had found a niche nobody else had done. So it was, I remember walking into Babcock, was C-Run at the time? I can't remember if it changed over at that point. The book's over 20 years old, so I don't think it would have been C-Run. And the response was very positive. You know, it's a little scary because it's not just a magazine article now, and the publisher's invested in you, right? So, you feel an obligation to them to make sure the book's successful and do everything you can. Again, this is pre-email. There's no social media. There's no way of promoting. There's no podcasts. There's no way of anything to promote your book. It's just, it gets out there and people accept it. So that led to speaking. Because I did a lot of research on that book on bugs. As I said, it all came back to that. You know, for 15 years prior to writing that book, I had either been doing, diet analysis, or as throat pumps became more common. I remember at Tunkwa Lake taking my kids at the time, because you could always get with a little, with a little toddler, you could get away with anything, right? Oh, you're so cute, right? Yeah, so, right. but ask that man. Because they would, right? And I would look at their stomach samples, or I could see the looks on their face. These guys, fly fishermen, are nuts, right? And I would see what was in them, and I just started simple notes. I wasn't counting everything in, but okay, there was scuds, there was chironomids, there was some leeches in there, and what basic proportions. And I just put them on an Excel spreadsheet. Over time, you had enough data and a little magic, you could turn it into a pie chart. All right, so that's those diet analysis charts that I put in that book. They're BC based. It's funny, as I look at them now, as I've moved out of the province, there's more, bait fish get on there. And as you learn more, it's the beauty of this sport, this addiction, is you keep learning, you don't stop learning till the day you stop breathing. More and more things come on, but the book was written based on what the fish ate and the fly patterns to imitate those things in relative importance. So for my analysis, chironomids were number one, and then scuds, and then everything else. And what I was also doing after reading Jack Shaw's books was, he had bugs in aquariums. So Phil says, I'm going to do this. And I set up aquariums, right? And we'd put these bugs in and put the weeds in and then watch them decimate each other, right? There was no way you could ever get balance in an aquarium. There was always one, particularly a dragonfly nymph. They were just, they would, I had one, I put him in, or her, at, I don't know, maybe an inch long in July, early July. And by October, it was 2.25 inches long and had cleaned out all but three leeches out of this thriving aquarium. It had pulled out, you know, would rip caddis out of their cases. It would, it looked like a medieval, it looked like a Game of Thrones battle scene. There was just bits and pieces of carnage everywhere. They'd eat each other. It was definitely, you know, if you look at, ever got into tropical fish, it was a fish that, it was a bug that didn't play well with others. it was total badass, right? So,
they're but vicious. That's,
oh, nasty, in a kind of cool way, the way they, that jaw comes out. So I was getting into, you know, bugs and raising them. I had them in the garage in my home in Langley because my wife, Patsy, she knew darn well what that meant. Very tolerant, understanding wife, and would not allow them in the house because I had hatches in February. I always joked I had house spiders like you're used to seeing in Australia, huntsman style. but a fascinating way to learn. And I had, you know, started to get to like entomologists like Rick Hafley, who's become a good friend of mine down in the States, aquatic entomologist by profession, merged as a fly fisher. What a great, like Brian, what a great combination, biologist and fly fisher. And, you know, so we would exchange information. I would make my observations. I remember we had a UBC professor at one time speaking to the club, and I had got into a conversation with her, and I had seen things she had never seen before, right? Because I had pictures to prove it, right? Like, look, they do those things. So I was just fascinated by all that stuff, and that's how Brian and I got to meet.
Right. Okay, so two questions on that. For, at the time, was chronomid fishing popular in British Columbia?
Yes, but it was a tough, tough thing to learn because there were no strike indicators. There were no weighted flies. You had to make the leader formulas. We're all out of Maxima, you know, nice, supple Maxima. I know streamer fishermen like using it, but for lake fishermen, it was the equivalent of yellow poly rope.
Right.
So not the most friendly for, and you had all these complex formulas, you know, different sections, little leader kits. I remember you bought this leader kit that was kind of U-shaped and you put the two, for tying blood knots, and you put the two pieces of material in and then put this like a little peg and spin it around and then hold it and then push the two ends through, pull it and withdraw it. Cause it basically, you know, a blood knot for me, I've never been a big fan of it in small sizes cause it's just too fiddly. Triple surgeon's not all the way. So, so we would have to put all those together. And, I remember the first time I, you know, chronomes are important. I remember this, elderly fly fisher, old timer, cause I are one now, so I can say that, said, you want to catch fish in lakes? And I, well, absolutely, right? Because your first thought is, that's a lot of water. Throw something big in that water. Big dragonfly nymph, big leech. You know, how's a fish going to find that? I can't believe fish eat little tiny. And as we know, they make their living eating those small things. So he opened his hand and had this, you know, traditional no bead head, black and gold, black body, gold rib, chronomid pupa. About a size 16, and I looked down and I said, you got to be kidding me. I am throwing that in all that water, and a fish is going to find it. So there wasn't a lot of faith in chironomid fishing at the time. Others were doing it. It was kind of this mystique thing, time served. And I remember being at one of those BC Federation of Fly Fishers fish outs in my float tube, first generation float tube that kind of looked like an inflatable toilet seat. Remember those ones?
Yeah.
I think I still have it stuffed and I can't part with it. I don't know why, nobody buy it anyway. It's ridiculous. No, you know, it's just first generation, and casting this out and you'd let it, that leader sink for all eternity, minutes, seemed like hours, and just slowly crawling this, like just half inch pulls at a time, and all of a sudden there was a fish there. And I'm like, holy Christ, this actually works. Right. And then once you do it, and then you get, now I got this, right? You got the confidence and you start going on it. So that, and that's still today my favorite way to fish, is that floating line, long leader. Of course, now we have much better leader material, much better fly patterns. Things sink better. You don't have to wait as long. You know, the fly line technology, we actually have fly lines that are actually designed to throw those kind of lines. I've had the good fortune to work with Rio to help develop fly lines for just that situation. So and chucking indicators and all that stuff. So yeah, that chronometric fishing was big, but it was a time served kind of secretive cult, hard to learn, you know. Everything was against you, from understanding the bugs to the equipment we had to use to nobody was telling you anything. It was kind of like macro photography all over again, right? And just frustrations. And then one day somebody blesses you and you've actually, you know, hit the pitch.
Right. Yeah, how come Brian didn't write the book first?
I don't know.
He was probably busy doing his biology thing, but he would have seen your book and he would have been very interested. So how did that whole relationship start?
Well, yeah, because it was, you know, I'd actually take it. Brian at that time was doing Stillwater schools at Lac Lejeune, I remember. And then he would come down to Ruddock's. And, you know, and him and I had got, you know, I just sort of, you know, talked to him. Right. And just got to know him and had conversations. And every once in a while, I'd phone if I was going to go up there. And he was always gracious enough to, you know, to give a, I'm sure it was a, you know, report just to, you know, not give away too, divulge too much, but to help out. And then I guess it got out that I had bugs in my house. And he had to do a presentation down at Ruddock's and called me up and, can I borrow some bugs? So I showed up with, you know, little buckets of bugs all separated so they didn't kill each other on the drive. And we went out for dinner. There was a little Chinese restaurant across the street from Ruddock's, and we sat down and we found out we had a lot in common. Both had young families, both like sports, obviously like fishing and fly fishing, and decided we should go fishing one time. So we did. And it's just sort of snowballed from there. And we have become, you know, he's just been, as you know, just, he's just a great guy and just so much knowledge in there and such a nice person and such a sort of fun sense of humor. Everybody, I think, thinks Brian's pretty, you know, conservative and quiet, but he is, he has that little sinister streak in him in a good way, right? So we have a lot of fun. Yeah, he is a lot of fun, a lot of fun. So yeah, we've just, and we just started doing things together. And I think we sort of both got in, we could be competitors with each other as I was starting to, you know, grow and have more success. We just decided, why don't we just work together? Right? Be collaborative and be better than the sum of our parts. Because sometimes just, I guess some of it was coming from my, you know, real job, if we want to do it, all the, you know, the confrontation and that was going on with that, you know, insurance and auto collision is, you know, it's a, you know, it's a, I learned a lot from it, but it was such a, you know, something bad has to happen before those services are needed. And you don't see people at their best. And you see a lot of, you know, unfortunate things, you know, there's, you know, not every accident's just a little fender bender. There's some, as you can attest to, some of them can be pretty serious. And so it was just time for a change. I just needed to, you know, I wasn't what I, you know, I realized what pilot didn't work out, but I always joke. It wasn't flying. It was fly fishing. I got the memo, you know, I didn't read the memo right to the end. I just assumed. And it's just, again, these little events that snowball, and some days it's a Kenny Rogers. You got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them, right? There's days you got to be assertive and say, hey, I can do that. Or think about me. And other days you just got to sit there and let people find you. Right. And it hurts, right? Cause you're just being patient you know, it's interesting how you, when you look back, people say, how'd you get? Well, it wasn't a university course. You didn't take 101 and then get 2 and then get 3 and then get 4 and have to do this. It just by hook and by crook and stumble, blind luck, good fortune, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, faith here you are. In the universe.
Yes.
So was Stillwater Solutions your first joint project? Because I remember being in Michael and Young, oh God, 15 years ago, a long time ago. How old am I? No. Yeah, maybe. And you guys had a material. I just remember seeing Phil and Brian's Material line. And to me, you guys were legends, right? Just these two. Whoa, look at their names are printed on packaging. Tell me a little bit about that. When did that all start?
That started, I believe, the folks at Fly Fusion had that one fly show in Vancouver in the tennis bubble in Richmond. And Superfly was there, and Brian and I were speaking there. And Jana showed us some material. She had some ostrich hurl that was really fine fibered, and people were still using white ostrich hurl for gill materials, you know, so old school now, but still a great material. And I looked at it, and Brian looked at it and liked it. And I said, boy, if you could dye this in different colors, this would be great for scuds and mayflies and a bunch of other applications. And, and then a couple weeks later, we got a call. Would you guys like to come out to Edmonton? That's where Superfly was based. And we spent a weekend out there. And I remember driving from the airport to, you know, you visit places and you always do things like, well, I wonder if I could live here. Little foreshadowing. We developed there. So there was a lot of back and forth with, we had picked a core through these discussions. We picked a core suite of colors, and don't ask me, I can't remember them all. Things like olive dun, light olive, olive brown. We had our own colors we wanted, they had access to all the materials we had been trying to find, or you could get from this manufacturer, but not that. And it all came together in a line of materials, fly tying materials specifically targeted for the challenges of, you know, tying still water flies.
When was that?
I'd have to have a look. I may have some old literature somewhere, but it's, I can't remember.
But it was a while ago.
It was a good, I've been out in Alberta 16, going on 17 years now. So that was already out. When I moved here, it was already at least probably two. Maybe 18 years ago.
I am as old as I think. I was afraid you were going to say that.
Okay. You're wearing it well, though. You're wearing it better than I am.
Oh, thanks. But yeah, it was a while ago. And then you guys also had that stretchy, like a floss, right?
Well, we had marabous, ostrich hurl, turkey quills, dyed partridge, stretch floss, midge flex. Midge flex was scud back. Mid stretch floss, and then we had super white beads because bead head patterns were just starting to really gain momentum. And white beads, we wanted a really pure, stark, bright white, not a pearl white, but a really, so they, the super white beads, we called them, I think. And it was you could buy it only as a complete package. The refills were minimums of six. Over time that changed because some dealers said, well, I don't want six. I want two. I want three. I only sell this. And ironically, what surprised me the most was the most popular selling product in that line was black marabou, which you can get black marabou pretty well. We were always amazed at that. Not any of the sort of boutique colors. They were popular, like Calabatus and olive dun and, you know, Kyabris green and all these crazy colors we came up with. But black marabou was the number one selling material.
Is that lineup still available? Do you guys still sell that stuff?
No. It got shut down. Brian and I decided to move on because it evolved. We started doing flies out of the materials, and we even co-wrote a book together called Stillwater Solutions Recipes that had flies tied with the materials in a book form. So we got into hand-tied flies as well by manufacturers too.
Coming up, Phil and I continue our conversation. Again, head on over to anchored.outdoors.com and look for the Masterclass tab. There you'll find all of our classes, including Brian's and other guests that you've heard on the show. So tell me about your first book with Brian. What was the book called?
The book was called Stillwater Solutions Recipes. So it was part of the Stillwater program that had originally started with materials. And then the next progression was to do a book featuring some of our favorite flies tied with those materials. And it was a unique little book. It was viral or spiral bound, whatever they call it. And it could sit on your desk in like a tripod triangle kind of shape, and you could flip the pages over and follow the narrative steps and tie the flies. So Yeah, that went, I think there was one run of that book, a few thousand, 3,000 copies, but I think it's out of print right now. You might be able to catch some of it through some, a few distributors still have a few copies on hand, but that was sort of the evolution of Stillwater. And then it rolled into Brian and I then developed the next step in the Stillwater Solutions line was actual fly patterns that people could, you know, purchase, because not everybody ties flies. In fact, that's, I think when I last saw an Aftima study, that was with the fastest growing segment of fly fishing was, you know, the hand tied flies. So we did that. And then we decided, you know, we both love Archeronomid fishing, as you probably know. So we got to, you know, we have these times where we get together and sitting, staring at each other or staring at an indicator and have these discussions about life and everything. And we should do a Chironomid DVD set. So that's what we did. We did the Conquering Chironomids DVD, a two-part DVD. We did a introductory, you know, introduce you to the insect and why it's important and the basics of strike indicators. And then volume two was all about advanced techniques. So more advanced indicator techniques, floating line, long leader stuff, which was sort of the first way you learned to fish chironomids, actually. Sinking line techniques, some dry and emergers, droppers, because although poor Brian can't fish droppers in BC, I tease him about that constantly. And, you know, we had a worldwide audience we were trying to appeal to. So both those have done very, very well. They came out in, I think we ran an original 1,000, and I think we were well over 3,000 sold of the hard DVDs themselves. And now, of course, everything's digital download, so they've sort of morphed into there. You can still get copies because we still have a few left. But, yeah, it's proven to be very, very successful. So
let me just dive deep.
Sure.
And it's going to be uncomfortable for a minute.
Oh, cool.
Did you have for a while there, were people saying that you were riding Brian's coattails? How did the industry receive you and this new collaboration?
That's actually a great question, because I don't believe I was. Brian and I were working because we were friends, and we had, I don't think we ever directly talked about it, but it just made more sense for us to be work together, to be better than the sum of our parts rather than be competitors doing the same thing. It just made sense. So, I remember one time Brian and I were at a show and somebody referred to us like Rick Haefeli and Dave Hughes, who are two American authors, and said, you know, Brian is like Rick Haefeli with a biology background, and Phil is like Dave Hughes, which I took as a compliment because Dave's a great writer, which I still don't think I am, but that's how it sort of meshed. So we've never had that. But I will say, once I moved from BC to Alberta, I did get out from underneath Brian's shadow a little bit. And in a good way. It wasn't like I was trying to escape anything, but it just allowed me to sort of step sideways a little bit and create my own parallel path that complemented the both of us, because I got to, you know, experience different fisheries. I fished predominantly in British Columbia for 35 years. And all of a sudden I was fishing in Washington State, Oregon, Wyoming, Montana, going down to Argentina, branching further east into Canada and doing my own schools and trips and really spreading my own brand that complemented what Brian and I were doing. So overall, it worked very well.
Yeah, I watched it happen, and I've never heard anyone say that, but being from BC, mm-hmm. I know how difficult that mm-hmm. crowd can be. There's a lot of talking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I just was wondering if you ever suffered with that. And then I just do remember watching you kind of veer off in your own direction mm-hmm. and become your own brand, which was really cool to watch.
Well, some of it was by financial necessity too, right? Because Brian had, you know, he'd worked for the ministry and then into the Freshwater Fisheries Society of BC. And now he's, you know, enjoying the benefits of his hard work in retirement and gets to, whereas you and I are like, I need to pay a mortgage. So how am I doing that? So, you know, and I, like Brian, we both like to teach and give and pay it forward, because we were I've learned a lot from Brian and others like yourself and you want to pay that forward, because we don't get hit with a beam of light overnight and all of a sudden we're 10% smarter. We learn, right? And we interact with others. And sometimes it's a totally different, it's a saltwater fly fishing discussion. And some techniques, some setup is like, oh, wow, that'll really help me in my stillwater game, right? I'm going to do that, right? And people come, where'd you learn that from? I read it on the internet. I talked with so-and-so, and that's how they do it. Saltwater, like the non-slip loop knot. Learn that from Lefty Cray. And I figured if it's good enough for tarpon, it should be good enough for trout. So, and it has been. So there's lots of that. Sometimes I remember being at shows, seeing some, I would watch somebody tie a sailfish fly. You know, it's 14 inches long and, you know, totally non-trout. And I'd say, you need to see that. And I'd have people go, no, I'm never fishing sailfish. Said, that's not the point. You should see how he manipulates flashaboo. He just solved my problem that I've been trying to deal with, tying flashaboo bodies on chironomids or something like that. So there's so many transferable skills and knowledge out there. If you just keep your eyes and ears wide open, you learn a ton.
Yeah, that's something I've never understood, you know, like we do monthly tying nights for our members. And as you know, because you're one of our presenters and you'll be, you know, you'll have someone say, oh, I don't tie crab flies. Yes, but a fly is just a collection of techniques on top of a hook. Yep. You could use some of those techniques in other patterns. So, yep, definitely. Yep. So what about you? Did you ever venture out that way into the salt?
A little bit. I did a couple of trips down to Mexico, which as soon as I hooked my first bonefish, that was all I thought about for 6 months, right? It's like catching my first steelhead on the Dean. That was it. I was to hell with still waters. I was going chase.
Definitely.
You know? And then reality kind of kicks in. And when you can get back up there and the financial realities of that and just doing the still water stuff. And as I may have said earlier, it was just, you know, people said, well, you should start talking about nymphing on rivers and streams and all that stuff. And I thought about it for a while. And then I thought, you know, I'm just spreading myself way too thin. This is sort of my niche. And sometimes I like to delve into those other things as more recreational. I just want to go fishing, right? I don't want to, you know, have to maybe do a hosted trip to be okay, but those kind of things, just enjoy the fishing. So I'd love to do more saltwater fishing. It seems every time I look into a trip, it's right smack dab in the stillwater season, right? That's why Argentina works out so well for me, because I generally like to go down there now, November, December, when our season's wound down and their season's just picking up. It works out rather well. So yeah, that's, I'd love to do more of it. I'd like to, you know, fish every day, but unless it's some kind of share agreement with Google or some master company that I'm just getting residuals from. There's some realities you got to work, right? It's not all play.
No. Well, you've just brought me right into my next point. Do you ever, or my next question, do you ever feel trapped in your niche?
Not so much trapped, but our niche, like fly fishing is a niche. And I chose a niche of a niche that, you know, it's not in the trout world. Obviously, everything is still, you know, and you know, this is such great river and stream. This isn't a negative thing. It's just that's the reality is most people in North America for trout are river and stream anglers. And then they slowly see the charms of stillwater fishing. You know, in my new book, it just came out in a whole chapter, like why, you know, why lakes? Why would you want to go fish a lake, right? And that was, you know, talking about sort of the crossover and some of the intimidation people feel about, you know, the river, trout stream. You can walk across it. It's got boundaries. I can see the other side. I can see likely look in places, whereas you look at a huge lake, you may not even be able to see the other side. You sure can't wade it. It just looks all the same. And then people get pretty, you know, it's pretty daunting for them. It's like, how the hell do I find fish in all this water, right? But so it, you know, it talked about those kind of things. But yeah, it was sometimes it's like, man, if I was a Euro nympher, I'd be rocking and rolling more, right? But you just keep every day, you just take one bite of the elephant and just keep, you know, plowing along. But the good thing is, it's people like myself and a few others, we're the only ones in that niche. So it's never going to be saturated. So in some ways we are the big fish and maybe the small pond, but it's fun. No complaints.
But there's never any sort of resentment to being put in that box. I know, and I'll just give you some context. I know for myself, you know, I'm the steelhead girl and it's like, well, I do more than that. Yeah. And then with Simon, you know, Simon Gosworth, he's the spey guy, but he's going, I'm actually a better single hand caster than a spey caster.
He is the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful casters I ever see. I hate him. No, I'm kidding.
He really is. He really is. But what about you? Do you ever kind of want to scream, you know, look, I can do, I'm not just a one trick pony. And then how do you navigate through that?
Well, it's funny. Sometimes you just, you do by showing, right? Like I've nymphed with some very famous, I fished the Deschutes one time and you know, I'm being watched and coming off the river, and wow, you can nymph a river. You do pretty good. You're doing all the right things at all the right times. I said, well, I sort of learned to fly fish rivers first, and I'm a huge study. You know, I often look to other fly fishing disciplines for answers to questions I may have in still waters, whether it's leader setups, presentation challenges, and just like trying to get your chironomid to sink as deep as it can is very similar to nymphing on a river as far as level leaders and, you know, the whole Euro nymphing thing, the pattern weight. There's a lot of, if you look at it with the right set of eyes, there's a lot of similarities to the same problem, right? That you can pull over to your niche and go, wow, that really works for that. That solves my problem, or that's something to consider and try. But I've the TV shows I filmed a lot of times when you're assigned with a guide, the first hour is a test. You know you're being tested, right? So they'll put the fly there. So I do, because I'm not going to go there and make a fool of myself. So I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I have pulled the hoops out. And if I know I'm the chance of casting to rising trout in tight places, I'm going to try and practice and make sure I can put the fly on the target, right? So, and that's, we don't fly cast enough. I know I'm rambling a bit here, but that's one of the things. I think somebody at a show said once, we were off going to the fly fishing show where I speak at a lot of times, you do the workshop, so you got to leave early. And it's somebody said in the, we're all going together as a group in the hotel bus minivan. And somebody says, it's funny about fly fishers, because in other sports, basketball players shoot hoops, golfers drive balls, soccer players practice drills. Fly fishers, we tie flies. That's how we practice, right? Because we rarely, you know, we all go out in a field and everybody in the neighborhood, there's no fish in the grass, you know, careful you don't catch a dog. It's like, yeah, I know, right? Or you got to explain it, or you give an impromptu casting lessons, and it's like, that's great. I've introduced somebody to the sport, but I never got my goals accomplished that I wanted to. So it's funny, we don't tend to do that, right? Same with knots. We all practice them on the lake and fumble them around and break them and, you know, sit at home and get comfortable with them. So. Yeah, it's challenging sometimes. It's challenging, but it's kind of fun too to sort of lie in the woods and surprise some people.
Yeah, exactly.
As I'm sure you've experienced on the flats or chasing other exotic fish and other fishing opportunities, fly fishing opportunities. Like, wow, that girl could cast. Yeah.
Well, funny, I actually fall apart the second that somebody is filming or watching. So I'll be casting like a champion, mm-hmm. and then somebody will float by and I just fall apart. I have mm-hmm. the worst anxiety really? Of anybody. To the point of extreme. I just won't even cast because I just look like a total ass.
Well, I've done that too. I have done one of the first shows I ever filmed was in BC on Jocko Lake, just near Kamloops. And the host caught a fish, and you know, it's early spring. We're fishing indicators and really skinny water because that's the best way to do it, right? We were all around sunken debris. We'd have just been hooking trees all day. And I decided while he was releasing his fish, the camera boat was sort of behind us, very close. So he caught his fish, turned to the camera to release it. Of course, I'm there with him to, you know, commentate and all that, and nice fish, the usual stuff that you do. And we hear this bang, crash, splash. Well, guess whose rod got ripped out of the boat on camera? Mine, right? Awesome. And of course, this is my first or second TV show ever. Like, this is, you know, my awakening, right? That something's good. All these little things that start early in your career that may amount to something or just destroy you. And you're just one of the many that crashed and burned on takeoff. And the friend of mine, Gord Honey, who unfortunately passed away a number of years ago, he was a former in the TV industry. He said to the camera, keep the camera rolling. This is going to be good. Friend, what a friend's for, right? And sure enough, there's my rod going down the channel on Jocko with just the tip sticking out of the water. And it's like chasing a dog on a leash. As you know, I picked up the anchor and I'm laughing away because it's not my gear. It's the show's gear. So I guess I didn't have that. Oh my God, all my best stuff is in the lake. And as I get closer to the boat, it picks up speed. And as I get slowed it as, and then it chases away and the distance becomes, it slows down. I picked up speed. I eventually got it, picked it up, fought the fish for 10 seconds or so, and then lost it, right? But it was so funny, right? But it was like, oh my God, what have I done? Right? Yeah. No, I've had a few, and I guess over the years, you just get more comfortable with yourself and just people say to me sometimes, that's great. You guys do that. You break fish off. It's like tying demonstrations. You bust thread. Oh, I'm glad it happens to you. It happens to all of us. Right. It's,
yeah.
And part of you, when you're tying, if you're not busting thread, you're probably not tying with the right thread tension anyway. Right. So you need to be, you know, there's times when it always breaks at the wrong time. It never breaks at the right time. It's always when you got that little tiny space to finish the head. Think it's like, Christ, now I got to put this thread back on and build up the head so it doesn't unravel on me. Yeah. So, no, I share with you, on that. You know, as you get more comfortable with it, you just sort of, you know, that's, I'm human.
Talk to me about flies. How come when I bring my chronomid box to the river, I get scoffed at? How can a river and a lake chronomid be that different?
They're not. The only difference I'd say is the size. Because river, that's why they're called midges, because, you know, if you fish a river like the Missouri in Montana, which, you know, was one of the things living in Alberta, about 3 years here before I realized there's the state of Montana right south, it's like, ooh. That's a place a fly fisher would want to go. So I get down there a fair bit and with the folks from Montana Fly Company because they're just across the hills in Columbia Falls. So and I've got to fish it a couple times. And they call them midges because an 18 is a big one, whereas that's a small lake chironomid, right? So but they still work. There's no, you know, today's chironomid patterns are bead, body, and rib. You know, a zebra midge works just as well in a lake as it does in a river.
Wait, they fish smaller in the rivers than they do in the lakes?
Yeah.
How does that work? You'd just think that you'd want to fish bigger because the water's moving and the fish don't have time
to
see.
But in Spring Creek systems like the Missouri, the midges are just small. And I think it's just, A, the species that live there. And I think because the water's moving all the time, they get more hatch cycles in a year. So the growth in between from egg to adult is less, whereas some of our stillwater species, because ice comes on, they're spending a year or more in that larval stage before they transform, and they just evolve to get bigger, right? Because I do, even you also see size variations on lakes from latitudes, so things tend to be bigger in the north. I think it's the influence of winter. Mother Nature is not cruel enough to make chironomids try and punch through 24 inches of ice in the middle of February. But further south with open water, like when I go down and speak in California, size 14 chironomid's a monster, right? It's huge. And then I show them some of the, you know, I'll bring some of the, you want to see big, check out my bomber box from British Columbia where we're fishing 8.2x. And they're just, they can't fathom a chironomid that size. It's just unbelievable to them. But I was down in Oregon a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic, doing a speak, and they took me on the Rogue River. And not the steelhead part, the trout. Well, the steelhead that come up there, but one of the hopefully he doesn't kill me for saying this, but one of his flies he was fishing with was about a size 12 ice cream cone on one of his droppers, and trout loved it, right? The good thing about trout and fish in general is you don't get entomology classes, right? They're not down there with a book going, wait a minute, nope, wrong time of the year, wrong bug, I'm not eating that, right? So I've recalled taking, you know, catching a fish on a lake and it's got another fly, somebody's broken off in its lip, and it's a stonefly nymph, a golden stone nymph. Well, they don't live in lakes, but trout don't care. It looks good. They eat it, right? Or they sample it, right? That's their hands. They're always putting things in their mouth they shouldn't. Somebody said to me, they're like a two-year-old. Everything's in their mouth. So.
Yeah. What about weight on the fly? Mm-hmm. Would you fish an unweighted midge in the river system, or would you always have some sort of a bead head on it?
Some sort of a bead head, because the bead head adds weight, but it's also got that little bit of flash and attraction, stand out in the crowd, you know, catch some light. You know, I firmly believe trout and fish in general, and as a steelhead angler, you know this too, they don't always take our flies out of a feeding response. They're samplers. There's attraction, there's territoriality, aggression, curiosity. So there's times when, like today, you know, today I was, before talking to you, I was out on the water with my oldest son and they weren't eating the imitative stuff. So I pulled out the sweep line with a blob on one end and this apse worm that looks, it's got rubber legs, floss everywhere. It's going through the water like it's having a seizure, and just ripped around at high pace and got a fish. Right. And that fish, there's no way, you know, the blob was hot pink with bright yellow. It's a friend of mine's, Matt's, he calls it the pink dancer with a shark. It's just like, there's nothing in a lake that looks like that. But rainbows love that thing. They just smoke it, right? And it's a great way to find fish. Maybe do careful throat pump analysis and then retune your presentation based on what you find, right? So, yeah, do that a lot.
What were they eating today?
Chronomids.
Yeah, okay.
And some water boatmen. Here in Alberta, our lakes have some incredible water boatmen and backswimmer activity, particularly in mid-September. It's, you know, in BC, I always remember a bit of a more focused two-week event. They'll start early September and run right till freeze up. They'll take them, and it's just some incredible fishing, just different bugs. So they always seem to eat them. You know, if they come across one, there's always one or two in there. So it's a good thing to have off a dropper. But they were eating, we were fishing, you know, a larger, more attractor style chironomid, a little flashier, stand out in the murk. And just because I'd got fish on a tractor, so I was just trying a little bit of a flashier non-traditional chironomid and then a blob up above it.
So is a blob the booby, or is it just truly a blob?
It's truly a blob. A booby has round foam eyeballs at the front, and then oftentimes a long or a short marabou tail, or maybe some flash, and then that fritz body material. That's the important part, is that English fritz. It's a chenille-like material, and there's different types now. There's Daphne fritz, jelly fritz, traditional fritz, slush jelly, that just so many variations coming out. And then the blob is literally just that fritz and no foam. And then I put bead heads on them, because it's in England, it's a pattern they cast and strip as an attractor. It's particularly effective. These attractor flies are particularly effective on freshly stocked fish, because they are new. They've been living in a pond their entire life. They get thrown into a lake. They have to go learn. So they sample and play with everything. So they're very susceptible to that. In England, it's called stocky bashing, right? You just rip and strip and catch lots of fish. But we also fish them with under an indicator, just like chironomids, particularly in the late summer, early fall, when fish have been out in deeper water, where it's more oxygen, cooler, and they're feeding on zooplankton. So zooplankton, they just swim through and filter feed. Basically, it's really high in calories, easy for them to eat. But, of course, nobody's going to tie size 96 flies, at least I won't. And so we use blobs that match or approximate the color of the zooplankton, because it can be pinky red, it can be chartreuse, it can be washed out. They have all these crazy colors like prawn and banana and milkshake that have nothing. Biscuit that is kind of a washed out pink. That if you're somebody to go buy biscuits, like what the heck color is biscuit? So we use blobs for that. There's another one called a fab, which has a really neat story. So in a number of the English fisheries, flies with foam in the front, particularly boobies, were being banned. Not because there's a risk with a booby or any foam-based fly that fish can swallow them, because if you lose contact with your fly, and because the this is what I believe, that when you're on a leader and you lose contact, that the buoyant nature or the neutrally buoyant nature of that fly is going to put a little sag in your leader. Fish comes up and grabs on, doesn't feel anything, and its natural inclination is to swallow, right? And you miss it. And then all of a sudden, he's tight, you bring him in, and the fly's, you know, you've piped them basically. So you've got to cut the fly out and hopefully it'll work its way out, right? So you've got to stay tight to them like that. So that's sort of the perils sometimes think with boobies. But I think it was more because a lot of the English fisheries, you pay for a bag limit, as I understand it. So you catch your four fish, you have to kill them, and you go. And so they were just sort of, you know, nymphing skills and imitative skills were being not being, you know, learned or passed on, so that they sort of banned them. But there's a rich competition going on in Europe, particularly in England. There's competitions, fly fishing competitions every weekend a lot of times in different waters. And so this, I believe it was a Scottish team, you know, sort of, well, if you can't have foam in the front, what if you put it in the back? So they took a blob and put a split foam tail in the back end, right? And when you fish this fly called a fab, and I'll explain what this stands for in a second, when you strip it, a booby kind of wobbles and shakes a little bit and rises and falls, whereas a fab, you strip it and it goes forward, you pause and the ass end kicks up, right? So it's got a different action. In fact, I like fishing them. But what they did at the end of the day is when they've had success with this fly, everybody's curious, like any time you're fishing, what fly we're using, what fly, they all want to get to see it. They would actually pinch the tail off. Oh, you're just using blobs, right? Because the foam changed. So that's how that fly key name is a FAB. It stands for a foam arsed blob. Right.
Oh,
and now yes. the fourth fly in this whole puzzle tractor now is called a Watsit or a jelly mop. And it's got a mop tail. Yes, the mop has made it to still waters. So it's basically a blob, that chenille, that fritz on the front with a little mop finger tail. And it's called a Watsit because there's a brand of corn chips in England called Watsit crisps that look just like a little mop finger. So that's where it gets its name from. So, and they all work. They all, I had a Watsit with me down in Argentina, a chartreuse one, and those big rainbows down there ate them. Just as, yeah. So yeah, we have the whole attractor thing is really taken off in still waters in North America.
It has. But the thing is, I remember seeing those flies 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
You would have remembered them 20 years ago. Let's be honest.
Oh,
what
yeah.
did you think about them 20 years ago?
And it was funny because I started really following the Stillwater scene in the UK in the 1996, the World Championships were in Kamloops. And of course, being from BC, they're fishing our lakes, we're going to do well, right? Well, competition fishing, as you probably know, is way different than recreational fishing. Different rules. For example, you fish lakes, there's no anchoring. It's all fishing from a drifting boat, lock style, so nobody can anchor up on one spot and own the territory. And there's lots of other pros to fishing lock style. I enjoy doing it all the time. And they came over with their methods and they won, Canada fished way down, and that sort of, okay, again, being a bit of a sponge for knowledge, it's like, I'm going to follow that scene, right? I started subscribing to magazines and going down to Chapters. Now it's Indigos, and getting Trout Fisherman magazine and just studying up and all these different techniques because it was so interesting. We're all trying to catch the same type of fish. Fish don't know international boundaries or anything like that. They're fish. And so how do they come at the same problems we do from different angles? It's a real eye-opening experience. As I'm sure you've experienced down in Australia and other countries who had the fortune to fish. He's like, ooh, I never would have thought of doing it that way. But what a cool way to do something, right? And then you come back and look like the genius because you're doing it. But for many years, I think we were so entrenched in our imitative styles. But now anybody that fishes lakes in British Columbia, Western Canada, and in the Pacific Northwest, and now it's not trying to isolate other states and provinces. I'm sure it's catching on everywhere. I can't account for everyone, but understanding the value, the time and the place for attractor flies and techniques.
It just occurred to me, I am assuming that everybody listening right now has listened to my episode with Brian Chan, where we really dive into the biology of chronomids and the chaebrus.
Chaebrus, the glassworms, yes.
There are people listening who have not heard that episode. Can you explain to people listening what a triploid is? And let's talk a little bit about, the black waters, panasks, and all that.
Yeah, those are fish strains unique to BC. But Brian will do this far better than I, but a normal two chromosome or diploid fish, trout in lakes have difficulty, or it's almost impossible for them to spawn because rainbow trout, like many other trout species, need moving water, a certain size gravel to spawn in. Like most things in nature, it's got to be just like Goldilocks, got to be just right. Or they won't, right? So they get egg bound and they can't reproduce, and it's very stressful on them. It's almost like the system has to back up, and that's not the way I think it was designed. So there's a lot of mortality. The males in particular become precocious. They mature early. And once a fish reaches sexual maturity, it doesn't grow appreciably anymore after that. So, there's a lot of mortality associated with this. And it just, everybody likes to catch fresh, bright, lively, sort of immature fish. So what the triploiding process is right after conception, they put those eggs in a flask, and it's either a combination of heat or pressure or both that by subjecting the eggs to this creates a third set of chromosomes, hence the triploid as opposed to diploid two chromosome fish. And a triploid renders them sterile. So when a fish has no growth or develop into the sexual organs, they just swim around and eat and get big.
Have you fished that Jurassic Lake system?
Three times. I do hosted trips down there now.
Now, every time I look, I see photos and videos from that trip. It's always people on shore. Do they ever get out in their boat and do it the way we do it?
No. And it's simply because of the wind. That lake is sitting right at the, you know, the eastern slopes of the Andes in Patagonia. So when that wind comes off the Pacific, runs over Chile, goes up and over the Andes and down, it comes. And we can have, the lake is known for its wind. I have fished in 75 mile an hour winds down there, which is, you can still fish because you're never asked to cast into the wind. It's usually, most of us are right-handed. It's off our left shoulder. So it's, our lines are being blown away or it's behind you, right? You never want to, standing is a challenge, right? But ironically, all the best fishing is within an easy cast length of shore. In fact, most times the guides want you to, if you can, to try and place your cast parallel, because that wave action that that wind creates just churns up, you know, the primary food source in that lake is scuds and zooplankton and snails, no bait fish that I've ever seen. So those fish are getting big eating scuds, which I always joke is like the carbohydrate of the underwater world, because it just packs on calories. So you get some, it's unbelievable. It's the World Series, World Cup, Stanley Cup of trout, stillwater trout fishing down there for me, for rainbows.
Do you ever think to yourself, if I could just get out to the middle in the depths where they're all the big winds are hiding, or is that just a grass is always greener on the other side?
I think there's a little grass is greener because you always think in anywhere you go, right? You know, steelhead fishing, if I could just get over on the other side, that part of the run looks way better than this. And then you get over and find out it's a foot and a half deep, right? It's like, I've done that in lakes. That looks so much better. Go into that bay. It's like, I'm going to run aground. I got to get out of here, right? It's not as nice as it looks. But again, most of the fish are literally cruising a rod length from shore because that's where the food is. So yes, sometimes fish go out into deep water and maybe they, you know, that's one of the times we like to use attractor techniques, because fish will feed out in deep water, but the food sources aren't as plentiful out there. You've got maybe leeches. And this is probably in a North American, leeches, zooplankton, and chironomids, you know, bloodworm, and then the ascending pupa. And that's it. Whereas you go in less than 20 feet deep, where all the sunlight penetrates, stimulates plant growth through photosynthesis, all that stuff. You've got damsels, dragons, mayflies, caddis, chironomids, scuds, crayfish, baitfish, all that stuff. It's just, that's the Walmart, Costco of the underwater world. So that's one of my sort of philosophies when I lake fish. If you're having a tough time, just go where food is, on the basic belief that somebody's coming in for a quart of milk at some point, right? We all have to do that late night run. We're out of milk. I guess I'm going. So it's that same kind of mentality that I'm thinking about. So in Argentina, it's the same thing, because the lake down there is, it sits in a cordillera, like a crater, and there's so much, it's such a calcium-rich water that the shoreline rocks are either worn from waves and wind or encrusted in calcium. So like you get on your taps, imagine that around a rock. You can actually kind of kick at them a little bit, and they'll break open at times, small ones like an egg, like a Scotch egg. You've got the coating on the outside and the egg on the inside, right? And there's a rock in there. So it's just from the spray on there, which, so you fish from shore. I did do one time out in the boat. They had a drift boat in one of the protected bays called Monster Bay. So I went out with one of the guides because they wanted sort of my opinion on, and I remember looking down at their anchor rope going, there must have been 200 feet of rope there. I said, what's with all the anchor rope? He said, well, that's to tie us to shore in case the wind comes up so we can pull ourselves back in, because that lake can go from flat calm to 4 foot swells in 20 minutes. That's why you'd never go out in a boat, because you'd probably kill yourself, right? And there's no, they drive you everywhere. At least the lodge I stay at, Estancia Laguna Verde, they have 14 plus miles of accessible shoreline. So you're two people per guide in these Hilux trucks. These are like Toyota trucks on steroids. They're just tanks. They go anywhere. You've probably driven them in other countries.
We have one.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody
in North, this morning.
Everybody in North America wants one of those trucks, right? Because they're just, I couldn't believe where those trucks go. And they just drive you to points on the lake, and you could fish as, you know, 5 feet from the truck, or if you want to hump a little bit, you can, you know, you can go a half a mile into these different spots. But it's a cool place, because you're fishing the same trout flies, scuds, leeches. Even though I've never seen a leech in that lake, it's again, trout, no entomology. It just looks good to eat. you'll get fish on dries. The most bizarre dropper combination I've fished so far in lakes is a mouse with a scud dropper, right? Because they'll come up and chase. So you'll be fishing an indicator. Trout, big trout will come up and roll on your indicator, and the guide's like, get the chubby on, right? And you put a big 6 or 4 chubby Chernobyl on, and they'll come up and eat them. And they'll eat them if you're stripped, which is something to see, this trout that looks like the size of a small child come out and eat your fly in this big, slow, lazy, these fish are steelhead size or better.
What about the fisheries with the ladders? Has anyone tried that in BC?
Not that I've seen. I've done Pyramid Lake in Nevada. That's where it's famous. A lot of our lakes, we don't have the bottom to do that. You stick a ladder in a lake, it's a step ladder at best, right? Or worse, right? You're up to your throat in mud. But those lakes are just the way they formed. There's lots of gravel and hard bottom to put a ladder on. And I've fished it a couple of times. It's a unique experience. Everybody, we customize our boats in Western Canada. They customize their ladders with rod holders and special, I got recognized on one of the lakes, one of the spots we were fishing. And so I got a tour of all these ladders and stuff. And it was unbelievable. But you do it because it goes out in the shoreline and then it drops off, and it's just be able to get out there. But the thing is, what happened to me is I catch a big cutthroat on there, and I've got to land it. So I got to get off the ladder, and I kind of forgot I was on a ladder. So I just sort of stepped off, which when you're 2 feet up or 3 feet up is a bit of a holy shit moment, because you're going down, right? You hit bottom, but it's that first second and a half is a little, I'm going swimming. But it's unique to that fishery, right? And I believe Lake Lenoir, they do it in Eastern Washington, and I'm sure there's other fisheries too. But in our lakes, they're often trees behind you, fringed with weeds. You just can't private access, land issues, and just muddy bottoms. It's just a boat's watercraft of some sort's always better. We're still fishing the edges most of the time. It's kind of like river fishing. Everybody on the bank is trying to hit the middle, and everybody in the drift boats is trying to hit the bank. We're never quite happy with where our flies are going, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your latest book, let's dive into that for a minute. What is the biggest aha moment people are going to take from it? People who have been following you for years, is there anything new in the book?
My three books prior to this were mostly fly tying with entomology scattered in, a little bit of presentation. This book is all about how to fly fish lakes, sort of from what I've learned over the years from people like Brian and others. So it's everything. The publisher was, you agree to these things, about 100 pictures and 80,000 words. Well, sure. It's like, how long is a piece of string? It sounds good. And the book finished up at 110,000 words. And I had to pull a chapter out on etiquette, but left that one out and had to some of the descriptions I had under the fly patterns, unfortunately. I'll have to do that book too, which won't be for a while. I have a hard time writing an email right now with all that writing. And about 300 images and graphics. My son, Sean, who's a graphic artist, did the graphics for me, the line art and all that stuff. So that was good to have. But it's everything from equipment, floating line techniques. That was fishing long leaders and indicators. That was 7,500 words, I think. Attractor techniques, an introduction to lock style, big entomology chapter. Rick Heifley helped me with that. How lakes work. Brian helped. He proofread that chapter. That was the first chapter I wrote. I had to get a chapter into the publisher by a certain date, I think, to prove that I weren't going to invest in somebody that, could barely write an email. That passed. And then Brian, I wrote it up, and Brian made a few minor changes, like more grammar than, some grammar things, and or just a, plural of this or that, and said, reads good. So I was like, ooh, I'm really happy. So that I got, when I wrote the book, I went and tackled the what I felt was my, where I was most vulnerable was that. Right? I knew bugs. I'm as bug crazy, or perhaps more, as Brian, because I actually had bugs in aquariums, right? I was studying them and sending pictures to people like Rick. Hey, have you ever seen this before? Because I never have. And please explain. Because I'd never seen it in the book. You'd see some caddisflies crawling out of the water to emerge. I'd never seen or heard of that before, right? And it's, you know, when you read a little, you read Gary LaFontaine's book, Caddisflies, one of the first classics in that genre, it was like, oh yeah, they do. It's one of those chapters you just kind of think, points you kind of breeze over the first time you read it. It doesn't sink in. So it's yeah, 110,000 words, dry fly techniques on lakes, sinking line techniques, knots and leaders. I should have the book in front of me, but it's a lot. You know, I basically... somebody told me it's a tome. And I think they were being sarcastic in their comment there. It's like the book weighs over 2 pounds. So shit, my wife and I took, because Brian and I have our own online Stillwater fly fishing store. That's another thing we've done together. And I spent $2,000 in shipping on the first day. The post office, you know, it was, you know, the shipping's all part of the purchase, but the poor people at Canada Post and our local post office, which I've come to know quite well because I'm in there every day, their eyes bugged out of their head because we just kept coming in with more and more and more and just shipping them all over the place. So it's been a cool experience.
Why did you take out etiquette?
It was a clean cut. That was one of the reasons I had to drop, you know, they said, you know, this is because I think it's important for people to understand that these publishers are taking a financial risk with you. They're the ones, you know, this is not self-published because it would, as you probably know, it costs a lot to self-publish a book. And I didn't think the economic return would be there. If I was going to invest that kind of money, I'd Bitcoin or something better. Yeah. Maybe. not that I understand Bitcoin, but, you know, so there's, you know, and it just impacts the printing and just the overall cost of the book. And especially as we talked earlier, it's a niche of a niche, right? Yeah. So that's why it was just a clean cut because, you know, it was important. I think the gist of that chapter was, you know, understanding that when you see, you know, infractions, like one of my pet peeves on a lake is people that assemble their boats and block the launch and while they're doing it, right? That's stuff you do up in the parking lot, those kind of things, because it's, you know, it happened today, right? It's just like you're blocking the launch. I'm ready to go, right? And but it's not, it doesn't turn you into a police officer, right? It's actually a point of education, right? Because some people just don't know, right? Are you going to be here a while? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was blocking the launch. Yeah, you know, that's why the parking lot's up there. It's probably better. You might sometimes somebody, like you do that on some rivers that have a lot of guides on them and you're the recreational angler and there's 9 guide boats lined up, you're going to find out really soon about blocking the launch is all about, right? Whether that's a river or lake, you're going to hear about it.
So can people buy your book now? Where can they buy it?
Yeah, it was, release date was May 1st. You can buy it through all the usual sites, but I have it on mine and Brian's Stillwater Fly Fishing Store, the stillwaterflyfishingstore.com. That was a store Brian and I set up. And I may have said it earlier, but, you know, people were questioning, you know, where do we get this and where do we get that? And we would tell them where to go. And then they go try and get it. And it wasn't there anymore. And people were accusing Brian, you know, like, I can't find it. And it's our fault, right? So we finally said, why the hell don't we do this? So we sell our flies there that are tied on our behalf by Montana Fly, strike indicators, our DVDs, Brian's books, my earlier books, if they're still in print. I think my first one's finally out of print. And then now this new book. So it's available there. And all of the books that come, we're not Amazon, so we can't do Prime or free shipping. I'd like to, but maybe someday. But they're all autographed, right? So it's a little value added we can offer. But you can also get them from Amazon and Barnes and Noble and all of those other books. You just Google it online. But if you bought from our store, Brian, and I would sure appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll include all the direct links too, because sure. I think that's really, really important. Well, Phil, I just think you're an absolute treasure and I love speaking to you.
Thank you.
I hope that we can do it again.
Yeah, let's make this a habit. It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're saying you started a YouTube channel and it would be really cool to do some collaborations there.
Let's do that. Yeah. YouTube channel. I just passed over, I think you're more than me. I checked, 10,300. So, but that was a milestone because it started out as fly tying and now has evolved more into, you know, a few how-to videos and vlogs and just a day on the water, kind of edutainment, I call it, a little bit of education, a little bit of me being an ass, you know, you know, real stuff. Yes, Phil breaks fish off. Yes, Phil hooks himself with an errant cast.
Yeah. No, I love it. I think it's great. Before we wrap it up, is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
I can't think of anything. I think we've talked about lots of things. You know, I want to find out about.
I've seen you a lot lately.
Okay, sorry. But it's been great to see you and to catch up because we both, you know, sort of grew up in the same area. And have similar experiences and talk. Probably some of your listeners are might be going, where are they talking about, right? Because some of the local nuances and references we're talking about. But no, it's been great to catch up. I'm so proud of what you've done, and you know, yay Canada. I think Brian said it as well. Just proud of what you've done and the roads you've forged and the barriers you've had to crash through that people like myself get to benefit from. So thank you as well.
Thank you. No, thank you. Cool. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time. I'll include all your links and let's be sure to stay in touch.
Definitely.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.